Musk and Trump for saying that they were firing striking workers or celebrating firing striking workers, which is illegal. Talk about Elon Musk and his relationship with UAW and Donald Trump and his relationship with UAW and Sean Fain.
Yeah, I mean, Elon Musk has had a very, very contentious relationship with the United Auto Workers Union. Elon has been famously anti-union for Tesla. His Fremont factory, where these cars are assembled, is not unionized. And Elon has gotten into some hot water over the years about his comments about union activity at Tesla. And it's also the reason that he was on the outs or is on the outs with the Biden administration. You know, he's one of the only U.S. automakers that isn't a unionized shop, and he was ostracized because of that decision. So this is, you know, par for the course with friction between the union and Elon. What's interesting is the Republican Party has been trying to court union workers and is trying to make themselves look more pro-union. So we're seeing this confluence happening with what each party stands for and, like, some blurred lines there as well.
So let's stay at the Republican convention where we were broadcasting from in Milwaukee next week. Of course, we're headed to the Democratic convention. We'll be broadcasting from Chicago. But Teamsters President Sean O'Brien asked both conventions if he could address them. The Republican National Convention said yes. This is what Sean O'Brien had to say.
And here's another fact. Against gigantic multinational corporation, an individual worker has zero power. It's only when Americans band together in democratic unions that we win real improvements on wages, benefits, and working conditions. Companies like Amazon are bigger than most national economies.
So that's Sean O'Brien, the president of the Teamsters. Dana Mattioli, you are the author of the new book, The Everything War, Amazon's Ruthless Quest to Own the World and Remake Corporate Power. Talk about what Sean O'Brien was talking about and talk about Amazon when it comes to the Republicans, when it comes to the Democrats, when it comes to its power in the world.
I mean, Sean O'Brien is right. Amazon's sales are bigger than the GDPs of many nations. And my book chronicles its rise from unlikely successful garage startup to the most dominant force in American business history, almost like the equivalent of a modern day Standard Oil. And the tactics it uses, illegal or unethical or anti-competitive, to put its finger on the scale and dominate industry after industry, and the effects that has on our economy, job creation, or, you know, losing jobs, bankruptcies, and innovation. And, you know, Amazon has had a really bumpy history with both the Republicans, specifically Donald Trump, and also the Democrats. You know, Biden has been really tough on Amazon. He put in place Lina Khan, the head of the Federal Trade Commission, the agency overseeing them, and she brought forward this historic monopoly lawsuit against the company last year. So they've had this scorched earth approach to government relations and public relations that has made enemies on both sides of the aisle.
And why did you decide to write an entire book on Amazon?
Yeah, I was the Wall Street Journal's mergers and acquisitions reporter. And in that role, I noticed over 6 years, CEOs of the retail companies in the beginning were nervous about Amazon. By the time I left the M&A job after 6 years, every CEO that I spoke to was nervous about Amazon. The industrial CEOs, the healthcare companies, the logistics companies. It was being invoked in every boardroom in corporate America as a source of fear. People thought it was going to eat their lunch and take their business. And I wanted to get to the bottom of how they penetrated industry after industry and became the top player, top one, two, or three player in like 12 different industries. And I set about investigating the company, and I found just a ton of business practices and driven by this toxic culture at Amazon, where the company lied, spied, cheated its way to the top. And I thought this book would be the perfect medium to bring light to those tactics, to show consumers, Americans, people around the world, why Amazon always seems to win, And oftentimes it's because it has its fingers on the scale.
And I want to talk about something that's been a controversy, someone who has become a controversy now with the Democrats. I want to ask you about the current Federal Trade Commission chair, Lina Khan, who you write about in your book on Amazon. Last year, the Federal Trade Commission in 17 states sued Amazon, saying it had illegally stifled competition. In May, Khan was asked about Amazon in an interview on ABC's This Week with Jonathan Coral.
You obviously made your name talking about the threat of Amazon as effectively a monopoly power. In what way is Amazon a monopoly? Because I can buy on Amazon, but I can also go down the street and I can buy at Walmart or I can buy at Target. I mean, how is Amazon a monopoly?
A few ways that we can tell that it's a monopoly is because it, too, is acting in ways that involve mistreating its customers. We've seen that.
How so?
The fees that it charges small businesses have dramatically increased over the last few years, so that now some small businesses have to pay $1 out of every $2 to Amazon. Mm-hmm. It's basically a 50% Amazon tax. Our lawsuit also alleges that Amazon has been using a whole set of secret algorithms to quietly raise prices for consumers. And so we allege that they've been able to get away with doing this through a whole set of illegal tactics that make it difficult for rival e-commerce websites to really stand up and enter the market and compete.
So that was Federal Trade Commission Chair Lina Khan. Dana, your book opens with what one of your sources calls the most important law review article written in our lifetimes. That was a reference to an article Lina Khan wrote in 2017 headlined Amazon's Antitrust Paradox, which was published in the Yale Law Journal. Lina Khan argued Amazon is a monopoly that had, quote, evaded government scrutiny. Two major Democratic donors, media mogul Barry Diller and LinkedIn co-founder Reid Hoffman, have publicly called for Kamala Harris to fire FTC Chair Lina Khan, who has led Biden's antitrust efforts. That's if Kamala Harris becomes president. Hoffman sits on the board of Microsoft, which was sued by the FTC. Hoffman was recently interviewed by CNN's Jake Tapper.
Thanks for joining us. So you and other big money donors are giving money to Vice President Harris, suggesting also that she replace the head of the FTC, which impacts policy and the economy. What do you say to somebody who watches this and says, this isn't how American politics should work, rich people getting to buy levels of influence?
Well, I totally agree with not buying levels of influence. I separate my role as a donor and expert. So if you ask me as a donor, I say I'm giving money to Kamala Harris because I think she's the best future president for the U.S., for business, for a bunch of other things. If you ask me as an expert about what, you know, kind of Lina Khan is doing and whether I think she is helping or hurting America relative to your anti-merger policies, which are, you know, mostly to bring litigation versus, you know, really solidly grounded in kind of what's going on, what helps American business thrive here and overseas, then I give an expert opinion. But I think donor and expert should be kept separate. And I've never tied the two ever in any conversation anywhere I've ever had.
So that's billionaire donor Reid Hoffman, who has given $10 million to have Kamala Harris elected president. Your response and the significance of what's the pressure that's being brought right now around getting Lina Khan fired, Dana Mattioli?
Yeah, Lina Khan has become this lightning rod in CEO circles, but specifically in tech circles. We've seen CEOs and VCs become very frustrated with the FTC under Lina Khan because she's been very critical of them. She's taken a very close look at their companies. They've brought lawsuits against all big four tech companies between the DOJ and the FTC, as well as other companies. So it's not surprising. But Biden has been a staunch advocate of hers. The big question mark is what Kamala does if she were to become the president. Interestingly enough, this is another area where there's been some confluence. J.D. Vance is a big Lina Khan fan, as is Matt Gaetz. So there are some really rightward-leaning Republicans that are her fans. They call themselves the conservatives. So this is a very big question mark for whatever administration takes over is the fate of Lina Khan and what that means for regulation at the antitrust levels.
And where do you see, what do you see as the fate of Amazon? I mean, there was just a massive Google lawsuit finding it is monopolistic. What about Amazon?
I would say that Google lawsuit from the DOJ, where the Department of Justice, you know, they won their case, that bodes really well for Amazon, which is being, you know, sued by the FTC. It won't go to court till 2026, so there's a lot of time in between now and then to see what would happen. But if Lina Khan and the FTC wins that case, it could have lasting effects for the company. It could mean a breakup in some ways of how Amazon works and whether, you know, its retail business is tied to its logistics arm or other areas that could be paired off. So this is something that could be really historic, depending on which way the dice roll.
And when you say it bodes really well for Amazon, you mean for the breakup of Amazon?
Well, it bodes really well for the FTC's case, I would say.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dana Mattioli, for joining us, author of the new book, The Everything War, Amazon's Ruthless Quest to Own the World and Remake Corporate Power. Dana's a senior reporter at The Wall Street Journal. We'll link to your article, Inside Elon Musk's Hands-On Push to Win 800,000 Voters for Trump. Coming up, the prominent Bethlehem Palestinian pastor, the Reverend Munther Isaac, joins us here in our New York studio. He'll be giving a major address tonight at the historic Riverside Church. Stay with us. Finding Strength Through Change by Lee Dines and the Jazz Tellers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Israeli bombardment of Gaza continues with 36 Palestinians killed in the last 24 hours, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. Among those killed on Tuesday were two newborn twins, a boy and a girl. They were 4 days old. When their father went to register their births at a local government office, the home where they were sheltering near Deir al-Balah was bombed, killing the newborn twins, their mother and their grandmother. The Gaza Health Ministry says 115 newborns have been killed in Gaza since October. According to the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, out of nearly 17,000 Palestinian children killed by Israel in Gaza over the last 10 months, about 2,100, more than 2,000, were babies under the age of two. As we broadcast, nearly 40,000 Palestinians in Gaza have been killed since October, though the true casualty figure is likely far higher, with thousands of dead unaccounted for. Meanwhile, the Israeli military has issued additional evacuation orders for Khan Yunis. The vast majority of Gaza's population has been forcibly displaced, often multiple times. According to the UN, around 84% of Gaza's territory has been placed under evacuation orders by the Israeli military. in the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces have raided towns and villages across the territory. In the northern town of Tamun, Israeli forces seized the bodies of four Palestinians killed in a drone strike. Over the past 10 months, Israeli forces have increasingly used aerial strikes in the occupied West Bank, a practice largely not seen in the territory since the end of the Second Intifada in 2005. In the South Hebron Hills, Israeli forces demolished six more homes of a Bedouin community in Masafriyata today. And in occupied Jerusalem, hundreds of Israeli settlers stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound for the second straight day under the protection of Israeli security forces. This all comes as the U.S. State Department announced Tuesday it's approved $20 billion in arms sales to Israel, including scores of fighter jets and advanced air-to-air missiles. In response to that announcement, our next guest, the prominent Palestinian Reverend Munther Isaac, posted on social media, quote, "The U.S. is funding the genocide. Faith leaders must speak up. Words of concern and void calls for peace are not enough. Speak truth to power. Silence is complicity," end quote. The Reverend Munther Isaac, a Palestinian Christian theologian, is the pastor at the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank. He's in the United States on a speaking tour and will be giving an address tonight at the historic Riverside Church titled "Silence is Complicity." The Reverend Munther Isaac joins us now in our New York studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me.
We spoke to you at Christmas time in Bethlehem, where you had set up this crèche scene, Christ in the Rubble. This is many, many months later. Talk about why you're in the United States, Reverend.
Well, I wish I was not here. I wish I was here in different circumstances. We're still calling for a ceasefire. And it feels like we're still calling for the world to humanize the people of Gaza, to humanize Palestinians. So I'm here to talk to faith leaders, and particularly church leaders, my own community, to speak louder. For it's been 10 months now since this war has broken. And we're tired of void calls for peace. We're tired of the same kind of discourse. And it's time that the voices of faith leaders, it must be heard, given that we are in the country that's funding this genocide, given that we are in the country that continues to give political cover to this war in Gaza. So if you're silent, knowing how your money is being spent, that means you approve. And so enough is enough. And I hope that more and more faith leaders, pastors, theologians, clergy, speak up more so that this tragedy in Gaza stops.
You know, yesterday we spoke with the Israeli peace negotiator, Daniel Levy. He was a negotiator under two Israeli prime ministers. And he criticized Zionist extremism and talked about what it means, what we're seeing now play out in Gaza. You're a reverend. If you can talk about the Christian Zionist evangelical community here, explain to people who they are and how much power they have.
Well, Christian Zionists are Christians who endorse the vision of Zionism of bringing Jews to Palestine. What many people don't realize is that Christian Zionists are actually far more in number than Jewish Zionists, and that Christian Zionism predates Jewish Zionism. Christians began dreaming of this concept of bringing Jews to Palestine long before the modern Zionist movement. And the idea was that Jews will someday be restored, using a theological term which really means convert to Christianity, embrace Jesus as their Messiah, and for that to happen, they must be in Palestine, the biblical land. And many Christians would then add that for the second coming of Christ to happen, this must happen first. So they tied to the second coming of Christ. And today, this movement has grown to become a very strong political force, giving millions of dollars and very much engaged in political lobbying on behalf of Israel. We have many congressmen and women actually repeat Christian Zionist phrases like, you have to bless Israel, Israel is chosen by God, it's a Christian commandment to support Israel. And when during the Trump presidency, Trump moved the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, the American embassy, Trump said, and I quote, I did it for the evangelicals. So this is a very strong political force, which brings me back to what I was saying, that we can't be silenced when the Bible is weaponized. Right now, to continue a genocide in the same way, because when we look at Zionism and Christian Zionism, in reality, they have contributed to the Nakba in 1948, to the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, of Palestinians, many hundreds of thousands of refugees. Israel was not created on an empty land. And as a pastor, I question, where is the concept of peace and love and justice and compassion in all of this? It's shocking to us that many Christians don't see even the humanity of Palestinians because of this theology.
Have you spoken to the lobby group Christians United for Israel? It's one of the largest pro-Israel organizations in the United States, has something like 11 million members. The group's annual summit largely focuses on advocating for increased U.S. military aid to Israel.
I've never spoken to them directly. I don't think they would even recognize me as a Palestinian to speak to. It's a very extreme group. It's a very militarized group, and it's shocking to me again that such a thing exists in our Christian thinking, because Jesus is the antithetical of all of this. And the twisted irony in groups like Christians United for Israel is that in the end time scenarios that they fascinate about, they think of a scenario in which two-thirds, when the Jews gather in Palestine, two-thirds of them will be massacred in a big Armageddon type of war, and then the other third will convert to Christianity. And somehow this group is considered pro-Israel or, you know, fighting for the Jews, when in essence, some of their views are truly anti-Semitic. And rather than channeling all of these efforts and movement into peace and coexistence between Palestinians and Israelis, they're promoting war, which again shocks me. So I hope they listen, but I also hope that people of good conscience in this country, faith leaders from different traditions, speak up against them, and many actually gathered outside of the meeting of Christians United for Israel to show their protest and to say, not in our name, and I'm very grateful for them.
Yes, earlier this year, nearly 150 Mennonites were arrested on Capitol Hill in an act of peaceful civil disobedience as they called for immediate ceasefire in Gaza. So clearly, the Christian community is divided on this.
It's divided. In December, in the sermon I gave in Bethlehem, I said Gaza has become the moral compass of the world. Gaza has divided the world, not on the basis of religion or ethnicity or nationality, but really on moral, ethical grounds. And it has divided even many Christians. And I think that's a good thing, because we need to know where you stand. And we're certainly beginning to see many movements among faith leaders, among Christians. For the last months, many, many Christians are speaking up, conducting not just vigils, pilgrimages, walking in the street, demonstrating. As you said, some have been arrested. Even in the university encampments, I've seen many of my pastor friends are there supporting the students, which has actually been one of my messages, that we need to defend, support and encourage those students and be with them. To me, that's where the street belongs, in the streets, where the church belongs. I mean, it belongs in the streets. So we're beginning to see a divide. But to be honest, by and large, the majority of faith leaders, Christian leaders in particular, are still silent or not strong enough in their calls for peace. Or, the United States is still funding this war. You can't just call for peace. You need to call out your political leaders. You need to speak to them. You need to put pressure on them to say this is not ethical to continue to fund such a war or to continue to give the political cover. So more is needed right now. I'm beginning to see some change, but with the urgency of the moment, the numbers of people being killed, 16,000, 17,000 are already children are being killed in this war. So we can't just resort to old calls. Let's pray for peace and hope things get well.
Has the Jewish opposition to Israel's war on Gaza surprised you? The number of people in the United States, Jews who've been arrested, who've engaged in protest?
Yes and no. And I say no because even before this war, there has been a divide. And actually surveys showed that, ironically, support to Israel among white evangelicals have always been stronger in the United States than that of the Jewish community. And I also say no because it's part of the Jewish faith and tradition to be for justice and you know, seeing the work with the civil rights in this country particularly. But yes, because it's really getting stronger and stronger. Groups like If Not Now and Jewish Voice for Peace and Rabbis for Ceasefire, they're really speaking up and being well organized, and not just speaking, demonstrating. Many of them, I think, have been arrested, and I'm grateful for their clarity in their opposition to Zionism, because we need to call Zionism for what it truly is, and it's not just that they're standing for a ceasefire or peace right now, but they're clear in their diagnosis of the problem. The ideology of exclusion that Zionism is promoting and supremacy has to be called out. And I'm grateful that many Jewish groups in the United States now and around the world is speaking up against Zionism.
Can you leave us with a graphic picture of Bethlehem, with your hometown, a religious site for the entire world, what it looks like before you mentioned a divide, the divide right through Bethlehem itself, the physical wall?
Amy, for the first time in history, Bethlehem and Jerusalem are divided. Bethlehem has always been kind of the little sister of Jerusalem. I still remember vividly when I was a child, my mother used to take us to Jerusalem for shopping. It used to take us 15 minutes on a bus ride to get from Bethlehem to Jerusalem. Right now we're isolated. We can't get to Jerusalem. Bethlehem is a little town besieged by a wall and Israeli settlements, colonies, suffocated in a very small area, and all the land, including the green area around us, is being confiscated by Israel, and it's out of reach to us, meaning we can't grow as a community, and we can't, you know, think of a future if there is nowhere else to go. They're clearly pushing us out of the country. And with the isolation from Bethlehem, and since October 7th, the restriction of movement even to other Palestinian towns, it truly feels like a city isolated. There's so much unemployment. And right now, all it takes for Israel is to close two checkpoints, and Bethlehem becomes another Gaza, another isolated block. This is true for other Palestinian blocks, towns, and villages.
We have 10 seconds.
So it is a really sad reality, and we're really anxious that this war in Gaza could expand to the West Bank.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, Reverend Munther Isaac, Palestinian Christian theologian, pastor at the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem. He's speaking tonight at the historic Riverside Church here in New York. His address titled Silence is Complicity. That does it for our show. To see our podcast, video, and audio, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Starting from the week of Monday, May 30th, the Student Union Building is open 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. The sub-building common spaces, along with the bookable spaces, are available for use. Any comments or questions, please go to the Simon Fraser Student Society website at sfss.ca for more information.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.